we're privileged to have someone who has proved his mettle and going to the heart of figures in public affairs, and who also continues to write in Newsweek for the benefit of us all who read him with great respect and attention. The first 100 days of the Bush administration, Evan Thomas.
Thanks, Ken. I'm delighted to be back here at the Miller Center. I want to say a word about the Miller Center and its importance, its real importance. You know, about 30, 40, 50 years ago, the academic world started to move away, academic historians, from the study of elites, on the notion that there'd been an awful lot written about military and political movers and shakers, but not enough written about everybody else. And that was true. And there was a proper swing of the pendulum to the study of the downtrodden and the oppressed and the average working people. And that was all the right thing to do. But as always happens in these things, the pendulum swung pretty far, and they stopped writing about what became known in amongst history faculties as dead white males. The Miller Center, and in a sense, that was left, the writing about presidents and military leaders and all that was left to the hacks, to us, to the journalists, to the popular historians, and not to the academics. Well, the Miller Center is performing an incredibly important function in returning a kind of academic discipline and seriousness of research to the study of policymakers, modern presidents in particular. It's sort of surprising to say this, but that's a neglected area in the academy. And the Miller Center, by transcribing these tapes and by doing this work, is performing an incredibly important function. I know this because popular historians like me and others live off of the fruits of what the Miller Center does, but so will historians for years to come. So I really am appreciative of the work the Miller Center does. Today, Ken used the word rough draft of history. I want to give you an extremely rough first draft of the 100 days. It's very tentative, but let me just talk for a bit about how George Bush is doing. First, the good news. George Bush is somebody who has learned from watching others, particularly his father. And he has learned to avoid stupid Washington flaps. There is almost a hazing process that the press puts new presidents through. This is true since at least Jimmy Carter. I can remember about a month or two into Jimmy Carter's administration when I was a law student here, sitting in the library up there, reading an article in the New York Times by a guy named Jim Wooten, attacking the Carter administration as inept. This is about a month into the Carter administration, and it set a tone that the press has followed ever since, which is a very strict and rigorous and sometimes sensational scrutiny of new presidents. As I say, almost like a fraternity ritual exercise, a hazing exercise. And most presidents fall into the trap. And they not only make rookie mistakes, but they amplify them by engaging in heavy spin and trying to fight back against reporters, in essence. Bush has had the keen common sense insight that it's a game you can't win. Bush, if you really look at how Bush has handled his first couple of months, he has not engaged in the same way, say, that Bill Clinton did. Bill Clinton had rapid response teams and the belief that you never let a news cycle go by without having a White House response, and he had armies of spinners out there, and he was constantly battling with the press to get the White House point of view across and sort of win this game. Well, it's a game you really can't win because it's set up by the press, by my folks, to be essentially a transfer of the story from the White House to reporters. In these, and then typically in these scandals and flaps, the story is essentially being controlled by the media. And Bush has rather shrewdly, I think, decided not to play. Now, that's not to say they don't have a press secretary and a communications director and they have briefings and all that. They just have not allowed themselves to get torqued up. And as a result, this has been a relatively calm couple of months. There hasn't been a cabinet secretary who's gone up in flames the way there has been with Tower and Bush 1 or all these poor attorneys general and Clinton. There's a whole laundry list of early attempts to create cabinet figures that went down. There hasn't been one of those, even though Ashcroft was a to-do. There haven't really been a lot of stories about how they're bumbling and stumbling around. There really haven't been many stories at all because there haven't been many leaks. This has been the most leak-proof early administration I have ever seen since I started covering Washington in the late 70s, early 80s. Now we hate this. I should say I'm praising it, but it's terrible for us because we really don't know what the hell's going on in there. We're always sort of guessing, but now we're really guessing because the word has gone out, and the Clinton folks like to play. They were angry at the press a lot, but they wanted to engage. It's a matter of honor and pride in the White House not to talk to reporters. This is a bit of a Republican cultural phenomenon. Republicans, not so much right-wing Republicans, but certainly moderate Republicans, take a certain pride in not talking to reporters. And Bush puts an awful lot of emphasis on loyalty, and he's made it clear that it's disloyal to leak. So as I say, this is all bad for my business, but probably good for his presidency, and I think not bad for the country in the sense that it kind of calms things down. You get away from the sort of feverish atmosphere around that was pervaded the Clinton administration. Now, it's also true, speaking of Clinton, that Bush has profited enormously by having Bill Clinton as his predecessor, not only as a model to compare himself, but the Clinton administration kept right on going through the pardon scandal. So all the journalistic juices flowed in the direction of Mark Rich and these floozy women who were around the White House. That entertained us and kept us occupied and kept the heat off of Bush. So in a way, Bush was lucky to have Clinton come before him. He also has quite consciously played off the contrast. You notice when you do read stories about the White House, they are about how meetings start on time, how they actually end on time, how people are respectful. They actually wear ties again in the White House. All of this is a conscious attempt to play off of the sort of the slovenliness that was characteristic of the early Clinton administration, not so much the late Clinton administration, but became the stereotype of the Clintons, as chaotic, noisy, stained. Even the fact that Bush goes to bed early is seen as a virtue, because Bill Clinton was always calling people at 2 a.m., waking up bleary-eyed cabinet secretaries and asking them what they think about X, Y, or Z. Well, that's not the best way to get advice, and it was sort of nervous-making. It's nice to know the president's on the job around the clock, but there was a kind of sloppiness and lack of discipline that makes Bush's rather modest work habits seem exemplary by comparison. Now, I think all of this has essentially been to the good, but there are some downsides to it, and as a journalist, I'm duty-bound, of course, to get to the downsides. This is shaping up as a rather unambitious presidency in terms of, if you think about what modern presidents have tried to achieve. Yeah, the line on Bush is he's more conservative than we thought, that he's not a moderate Republican, he's actually pretty conservative and even right-winger. And there's been a lot of sort of grumbling in the press about that, the press, whether or not the press is liberal, it's certainly not conservative. So there's been some muttering about that. But I think the larger point is not so much that Bush is truly conservative, but that his ambitions are quite limited. He's and I'll talk some more about each of these points, but I don't sense any grand driving dream here. I mean, I thought his inaugural address was wonderful, but I can't remember what it was about. I don't see any particular overarching vision. And you could say, well, it's the times are relatively calm. Now, the economy is maybe not so calm, but we have been in a period of relative tranquility, and so maybe there's not all that much to be done. But I would, if you look at Bush's agenda, it's pretty modest, and he's not aiming to do great things. In some ways, this can be reassuring because there's less risk of making a big mistake, but there is not certainly the kind of lift that you heard in Kennedy's inaugural address or in Johnson's Great Society or in Nixon's various overtures to the Soviet Union and to China and on domestic policy. Certainly nothing, although Bush compares himself to Ronald Reagan, he's not, Ronald Reagan represented a dramatic turn in the road. This idea that we were going to cut back on the size of government and strengthen our military and really turn to the right after a long period of relative liberalism, that was a sharp defining turn in the road. I don't see anything like that from George Bush. I think Bush is relatively modest. He hates being compared to Bill Clinton, but I think really you'd have to compare him to Clinton, because just as Clinton was modest in his goals, little incremental steps, mostly focused on getting reelected, that's the way I see Bush right now. He's really got his eye on 2004, and he's going to do just enough to get elected, praying that the economy turns up so that in 2003 and 2004 it's in good enough shape. And he hasn't done anything particularly wrong, and he's an amiable, likable fella, so we reelect him. Now, I think the problem with that is that there are some what they call opportunity costs. For instance, his tax cut, his big act is a tax cut. Well, on the micro level or on the immediate level, he's had a little bit of a setback there. It looks like he's not going to get $1.6 trillion. He's going to get $1.2 trillion. And there's some grumbling that he misplayed the Senate, that he should have gotten John Breaux under the tent earlier. And I think there's some truth to all that. They've only got it's a 50-50 Senate, and they've really only got Cheney's vote, and they're going to need these moderate Republicans, and they're going to need these conservative Democrats, and they probably haven't done enough to cultivate them, and so they're going to not get all the tax cut they want. But that, to me, is not the larger point. I mean, that's all true, but it's not. The larger point is that they're not taking this moment in time to do the really important stuff, which is entitlement reform. If you want to spend your political chits, I think a big fight over taxes is really not all that important. A tax cut as a stimulus is probably not going to have much effect, even if they do front load it and make it retroactive. It's probably not going to spur the economy that much. I don't think the economists really believe and the stimulus effect of a tax cut. And there's some debate about this, but I don't believe it wholeheartedly. In fact, the Secretary of the Treasury, Paul O'Neill, doesn't believe that a tax cut is really going to be a stimulus. Mostly, it's I think the real agenda of a tax cut is to take money away from the government so the government won't spend it. Now, that is a more interesting theory. And it is definitely true that if you give the government money to spend, it will spend it. So that's a more plausible rationale for a tax cut. But I think Bush is missing the real chance for leadership, which remains, as it has been for a number of years now, to do something about Medicare and Social Security. That is the long-term problem that needs to be addressed, and it's going to take real national leadership to do it, and it's going to take real presidential leadership to do it, and he's just punting it down the road. I mean, I think this will create yet another commission on Social Security, but they're really not stepping up to the hard questions that a president has to deal with for our fiscal health and for the provision of these services. I think the theory is, well, we'll win on the tax cut and we'll get some political momentum and then we'll take on the hard questions. Maybe, but the other theory would say, look, you've really only got this initial burst. You got to attack it right away. You really got to attack it in the first 100 days. You need to start laying the groundwork for it now. My fear is, and I hope I am proved wrong, but my fear is that they will win some kind of a tax cut, declare victory, even though it's not the all that they want, and then just sort of keep muddling through, and they won't really take on this larger, complex, and more important issue. On foreign policy, well, let me talk about the environment for a second. Bush's early record on the environment is troubling in this sense. It's probably too early to hit the panic button, and they say they're going to announce some measures that are a little greener than what they've been doing so far. But their early actions on the environment are a little worrisome on a couple of levels. One is just on a public relations level. There's a sort of a contemptuous attitude that seeps through Bush's handling of the environment. The Kyoto Treaty was probably a bad treaty, and after all, it was defeated by the Senate 95-0. So it's not as if Bush's refusal to try to enforce it is anything more than the Senate's already on the record as wanting to do. It's a flawed treaty. But instead of just preemptively just sort of rejecting it out of hand, it seems to me, and I think it seems to most commentators, that Bush would be wiser to say, all right, this doesn't work, but we want to start right away at looking at what will work. Let's get serious here about global warming and what, in a multilateral way, can be done to deal with climate change. Instead, their attitude is sort of giving it the back of their hand. And I think that's stupid on a number of levels. It's stupid because it makes our allies furious. Now, our allies are always furious. I mean, Europe always hates us, and the French always hate us. So, in a sense, that's nothing new. But there are degrees here, and there's a kind of cavalier quality in our rejection of Kyoto, which is, I think, unnecessarily inflammatory. To our various allies, there is again on this business about CO that we're not going to regulate CO2. That's not as get the Greens all upset, but that's not. It's a perfectly reasonable decision since I think about half our energy is produced by coal, and we couldn't do that if we were really serious about regulating CO2. I mean, the fact of the matter is, we are dependent on coal to produce energy, and we will be for a while. But again, it's the style in which it was done. It was so cavalier. It was just so peremptory. And it was walking off a campaign promise, which adds a further dimension to this, that it makes me wonder what they're doing in there. And I can only think that, well, a couple of things. One is that Bush has spent too much time around oil men. I mean, he has a kind of a macho attitude that is this is cultural and Texan, but it's something somehow unmanly to be pro-environment. In the loose talk in the world in which George Bush grew up and worked, the idle chatter, the cultural surround, would be to make fun of tree huggers. Now, some tree huggers deserve to be made fun of, but there is a kind of callousness and disregard that is part of the world in which Bush lives, of the energy producers' world, that I think has infected Bush a bit and the people around him. Cheney certainly comes from that world. And also Karl Rove, who is Bush's chief political advisor, I understand, is saying, you know, people are saying, well, gee, if we're too tough on the environment here, we're going to lose all those soccer moms, and we're not going to get reelected in 2004. You can't be that anti-environment and expect to take the moderate voters, the middle that any presidential candidate needs to win. We're going to alienate too many of those voters. Rove is saying internally, we don't really have to worry about them. We need to keep, if you look at the last election, the Republican Party is increasingly becoming the party of rural white males who don't really care about the environment so much, pro-gun. You look at this last election, and the Democrats lost it by losing a lot of those border state rural white males who had voted for Bill Clinton in 96, did not vote for Al Gore in 2000, and I think Rove is looking at that group as the base, the new majority base of his presidency, and thinking that you don't really need all these soccer moms if you hold on to those voters. And they worry a lot more about the price of gas at the pump and their heating fuel costs than they do about caribou in Alaska or vague notions that the sea level is going to rise at Nantucket sometime in the year 2020. Rove is just so far, now this could change, but Rove so far is not seeing a political cost in this attitude. I think that's unfortunate. Now, this is my own bias here because I'm worried about global warming and I'm worried about environmental issues. But I also think it's politically unwise. It may get corrected. I gather, as I say, we don't really know what's going on in the White House because there's so few leaks. But the few leaks that I do hear tell me that there is some internal debate now, and there is some feeling that they went too far on the environment. Now, it's hard to fight against Rove. It's hard to fight against Cheney. It's hard to fight against the president. But O'Neill, who's a bit of an odd man out now at the White House, is taking the other side, that we need to do more about the environment. Colin Powell is taking that argument. Now, he's got other fish to fry right now, so I doubt he's all that much engaged. But there are a few voices saying that we went too far and we need to come back. And certainly Christy Todd Whitman needs a victory here, needs to be able to say that she's done something about the environment or she's going to resign. So I wouldn't be surprised if they throw her some kind of a bone fairly soon and that there is some at least mild correction here on the environmental front. Foreign policy, Phil and I were just talking about this beforehand about whether Bush has handled this China crisis right or not. I think it's too early to know, but there is a school of thought that initially President Bush was a little bit too hands-off. He has tried to move away from, consciously move away from Clinton's policy of strategic partnership with China. I mean, Clinton went out of his way to try to engage the Chinese and use a hotline to Beijing and have some interaction with Jiang Zemin. When Bush came in, he de-emphasized all that. We're not going to have a strategic partnership. China's our strategic competitor. He wrote, interestingly, when Bush was calling various heads of state when he first came in, he did not call the Chinese head of state. He wrote him a note, but he didn't call him. The Chinese were all offended when we made a great effort to bring the Japanese Prime Minister Mori over here, even though his government was collapsing around his ears, to talk to him, but not to talk to the Chinese. So there was an attempt to kind of de-emphasize our relationship with China at the outset, and there's some feeling that we may be paying for that now, because when this crisis happened, Bush's initial reaction was at least arguably a little bit lax. Our understanding is that Condi Rice, his national security advisor, told him that, well, this will resolve itself in 24 hours, no big deal, we'll get these guys back, we just can just kind of lay low here. And so not a whole lot happened in the first 24 hours. Bush came back, heard about it Saturday night, went to bed at the usual time, came back on Saturday at midday, not for the crisis, but because the weather was bad at Camp David and he couldn't recreate with his buddy, his Yale buddy, Bully Betts, who was up there with him. And they really weren't all that engaged in the early going. Then, when they couldn't get anybody's attention in Beijing, but literally phone calls were not being returned, then they put out a slightly tougher statement on Monday and Tuesday. Bush is troubled, he wants his boys back. It's not until Wednesday that they realize they've got a problem here and they start to use the word regret. Not apology, but we regret the incident. As Phil pointed out, the former Clinton foreign policy experts are putting out the word that this was a bungle by the Bush administration, that if Clinton had been in office, he would have reached out right away to Beijing. He wouldn't have waited. He would have used the word regret early rather than later, and that by so doing would have not allowed everybody to get dug in, would have brought the crisis to a resolution earlier. That's all kind of, that's partisan, it's also perfect hindsight. I really don't know if that's true, but I do worry a little bit that at least at the very outset, Bush was perhaps a little bit too hands-off on this, and now he's in a ticklish position because everybody is dug in and the Chinese are being difficult. As you know, if you follow the news here, the Chinese government itself is divided. And we're not dealing with a monolith. The foreign ministry over there has limited power. The army, the PLA, the Chinese military is quite strong. They are pretty belligerent. They are not going to roll over easily. They're the ones who are insisting on this use of the word apology. The military is quite happy to stir up xenophobia in China because it's good for their budgets. I mean, the Chinese are just like us in that way. And indeed, I think a few years ago, the Chinese military lost some of its sources of revenue from corruption and private business. I think they took away their ability to pirate CDs. And it put a big dent in the budget of the Chinese military. And so they need money, and they want money. And a crisis with America is a good way to get money. So they have both a financial interest in this. And the Chinese government, I read, has been in a kind of messy business of riding its own tiger. In order to deflect attention from the moribund quality of communist ideology, they have over, especially in recent years, been firing up Chinese nationalism. It's an old trick. I mean, if you want to divert attention from the failings of your own ideology, all you have to do is fan the flames of nationalism. It's a dangerous game to play because, for instance, when we mistakenly bombed the embassy in Belgrade, the Chinese government bussed in protesters to stone the American embassy. Well, it got out of hand. They threw a few too many rocks, and the Chinese ended up having to rein in the demonstration that they helped create. Well, that's a microcosm of a larger problem of fanning all of this nationalism. But then when they get in a crisis like this, they're afraid of appearing weak to all of these xenophobes they've created if they back down too quickly. So they're all kind of hoist on their own petard here, and it's hard for them to back down. Plus, there are thousands of years of ritual about kowtowing, an apology, and face, which further makes it hard. I gather they're now dickering over the language over whether I'm sorry means I'm sorry, and trying to work out. I think literally is a Chinese word that the American translation is I regret, but there are several Chinese translations, one of which is I apologize. And they may slice the bologna that thin to have a word that means different things in different languages to get us out of this mess. I think our boys will come home, and this won't turn into a real hostage crisis, but it's a little scary because you don't really know what you're dealing with over there. It is a divided government. It doesn't really bode well for the future. I mean, this is a relationship we're going to have to manage for a long time. China wants to be the great power in that region, and they want to replace us as the great power in that region over the long term. They want to build up their military to do it. I guess historically they haven't been all that rapacious about invading other countries because they're a pretty big country themselves, but they have gobbled up a few of their local neighbors from time to time. It's a real problem. It's going to take real delicacy in handling it, and Bush is going to have to get up to speed. I mean, this is one relationship where you can't be hands off. He's going to have to learn a little bit more and be a little bit more engaged than he perhaps was at the beginning of this crisis. This is a learning experience for him. I guess that's the best way to put it. Now, let me just say lastly about Bush that all of this tea leaf reading is fine, but we won't know the essential thing, which is whether he has good judgment, until we're in a crisis, a real crisis. Now, I mean something beyond this. The problem with the way we choose presidents and the nature of the presidency is that we don't really find out if they've got what it takes until it's too late, until they're actually in the Oval Office and the crisis is happening around them. You know, there's nothing in Bush's record that's really going to tell you whether he has good judgment. I mean, did he make the right baseball trades for the Texas Rangers? He picked the wrong oil wells, apparently. I'm not saying that he has bad judgment. I'm just saying that we don't know. And we're really not going to find out until he faces the kind of crisis that he could well face, which is to say something that has really that puts the United States at risk, and where the intelligence is imperfect, as it always is, and he's getting conflicting advice, as he surely will, and he has to choose the right course of action, and he has to do it fairly quickly. Fortunately, if we look back in our past, we've had presidents who did make the right choice. Phil and the center here are continue to do good work on the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is the most dramatic case of this going. And fortunately, Jack Kennedy really had pretty good judgment, a better judgment than his advisors. Let's hope that if we get in the same kind of boat, George Bush does too. Thank you.
I hope we can make the questions brief, to the point, and prove me right on what I've said about the quality of the questions at this place. Who'd like to ask the first question? Mr. Arthur?
Yeah. I find it interesting you talk about Bush, and I haven't said a word about Cheney.
Well, that's an oversight. The question is, I've said a lot about Bush, but nothing about Cheney. This is my fault. Cheney's a hugely important figure here. He's not the prime minister, but he sure as hell is an important advisor. He chairs this energy task force, which is very important on this question of exploiting new forms of energy, but also environmental issues. So he has a big hand in both those camps. He chairs something called the Deputies Committee on Foreign Policy, which is where the rubber meets the road, where they really make foreign policy and implement it. That's a terribly important role for him. He is the gray eminence. He's obviously somebody that Bush turns to. He's the chief lobbyist on Capitol Hill. There's something called, the senators have started referring to as the torture chamber, which is Cheney's office up there, where he brings people in and holds them hostage until they vote. He failed last week, actually, with that Vermont senator, Jeffords. Apparently, it was right out of an West Wing episode where Jeffords went in there and shook him down for $400 million of money for learning disabilities, and didn't get what he wanted, but didn't vote with the administration on the tax on taxes. So Cheney is extraordinarily busy. He's also, I think, not a medical person, but potentially a powder keg about to go off. You know, he has his repeated heart episodes. There's sort of murky commentary on this, and irritatingly, Cheney does not release his medical records, his full medical records, so it's really hard to know what kind of shape he's in, but it's a little troubling that he's had these repeated episodes. And there is some body of opinion I read in the newspapers from medical experts who say he's a candidate for another. All of that is worrisome on many levels. So Cheney's a very important guy. I have heard, just to take the other side for a second, the notion that his advice is overrated, that he's one of these people who says very little, and so you think that he's about to say a lot. And he just sort of seems wise, because everybody else is showing off and tooting their horn and horning in, and he kind of sits back, and so you think, well, he must be the wise man keeping his counsel. But when he opens his mouth, not that much comes out. He's certainly not somebody who's going to steer Bush in the direction of bold initiatives. I mean, that's not his style. He's conservative himself, but he's a pretty cautious conservative, and he's out of this Ford White House, which was a pretty much steady as she goes crowd. Let's not try anything too dramatic here. Let's just keep the ship afloat, coming off the shock of Watergate. And so I don't think that he's a bold innovator, but he certainly is somebody that President Bush turns to, and in addition to his father, and thus is a very significant figure.
Al Fernbach.
Aside from the uncertainty of Cheney for the future, would you comment on the relationship with Congress as a whole?
The question is Bush's relationship with Congress as a whole. I think the current feeling is that they're mismanaging it a little bit. There was a lot of talk about bipartisanship coming in, and Bush very cleverly and skillfully charmed up senators and representatives in the first couple of weeks going up there and having some of his old adversaries. He had Teddy Kennedy down to watch 13 days in the White House, and just was very deft. But then, and this goes to this question of sometimes you can be too hands-off, stop doing so much of that. I know that John Breaux feels miffed. Now, John Breaux is an interesting character. He is a moderate Democratic senator from Louisiana with a fair amount of seniority, and I think he saw himself as the great deal maker, the go-between, the Democrat that the Republicans would go to, that the Bush White House would go to fix things and to create majorities and get things done. And Breaux rather fancied himself in this role, and I think was a little bit too open and a little bit sort of stuck up about it, about how he was going to be the great fixer. And I think it irritated Bush. And Bush did not turn to him. And Breaux, I know, has been put out by this, that the phone just doesn't ring. Now, Breaux was the one who was pushing this $1.2 trillion tax cut that passed last week. Maybe Breaux will be brought back into the White House tent, but he's been on the outs. And that's a problem. I also think that the White House has underestimated the resistance of the Republican moderates. Link Chafee seems like a very mild, green and brand new, and seems so mild. He's not. He comes from these flinty New Englanders. The Chafee family really is old-fashioned throwback to politicians who believe in principle. And although John Chafee, his father, had to scramble and compromise to get reelected as a Republican in a state that is about 10% Republican, Chafee was a man of real conviction and character, and his son wants to live up to his father and is going to stick to his guns and is going to be very hard to break on any number of issues. He's going to be to the left of the administration, and he's going to be hard to roll. Jeffords has been hard to roll for years. Olympia Snowe and Collins, the other main senator, are not going to be easy. So they've got a problem with the Senate where it's 50-50, and they've got a medical problem because Strom is hanging on by a thread. And I don't think Jesse Helms is in all that great shape either. So they could lose. They could easily lose their majority up there, and then they would have a real problem. In the House, I think it's always a problem dealing with Tom DeLay, who's a very difficult person and a bad public figure, and in bed with various interest groups, and some of those interest groups are the same ones that the Bush administration likes. But when it comes time to save money, which they're going to try to do in their budget, I could easily see the Republicans' leadership getting off the reservation on that. Congress wants to spend money at about twice the rate the Bush administration wants them to spend money, and that's going to cause real conflict and really test Bush. So this is a long way of saying that I would give him only about a B minus on his early handling of Congress. Nothing terrible has happened yet, but he's not building up great relationships, and there's some mumbling and grumbling. Now, dealing with Congress is a little bit like dealing with Europe. They're always complaining. So you have to take it with a grain of salt, but he could be doing better, and he will need to do better to get even his minimal agenda through in the next year.
Dr. Weary?
Bush is beginning to get some flack about his hands-off policy in regard to the California energy crisis. Would you comment about that, please?
I don't know enough about the particulars of that. It's incredibly complicated. I keep starting these articles about the California energy crisis, and I never finish them because it's so goddamn complicated. I gather the problem is that they just don't want to let prices go up. I mean, they're just going to have to let prices go up and let the market price place solve this. I have read that the Bushies were a little slow getting involved, and they're going to pay for it this summer when there are going to be brownouts in not just California, but possibly in New York and various western states. Again, this is just what I've read, that it didn't snow enough in the Pacific Northwest, and there's not enough hydroelectric power, so it's going to be a bad summer, and that's going to... I know the administration is worried about this, and they're pro-energy, and they like to look for them firing up a bunch of coal plants, I think, in the short run. You'll see coal plants that are now offline are going to go online. A lot of those green states out there in the far west are going to be happy to throw up some coal dust in the air to keep their lights on this summer. So that'll be the short-term solution in the west generally, but it's just a short-term solution. And I don't, you know, Cheney's working on a plan, but I couldn't tell you what they're doing.
Next questioner has been asking questions for 25 years. So
I read in the Cuban Missile Crisis that the Kennedys were so influenced by the Guns of August, which Barbara Tubman wrote. What are the influences of that nature that?
Well, that presupposes that George Bush reads books, which is a stretch. I mean, they always have him reading a book, but my guess is that Bush, by his own admission, is not a reader. They would like you to have him think that he reads books occasionally, and I'm sure he talks to people, but in a modern age, as a child, Bush probably would have been diagnosed with some kind of reading disability. I've talked to him about taking English at Andover. It was agony for him. He's a perfectly smart guy. He suffered horribly as a high school English student. He hated it, and he did badly at it. I think his first comment on his first paper there was, "This is disgraceful," or "You ought to be ashamed of yourself," or I forget what the... This is before the age of the self-esteem movement, when teachers were actually allowed to tell students what they thought. He's just not a big reader. He likes one-page memos. Now, you can make this a virtue. It's the Harvard Business School model of leadership, where you don't get too far into the details, you're decisive, you delegate. It's definitely a model of leadership, and it can be a good one. But I don't think there's any evidence that Bush is a detail man, or that he reads deeply or thinks hard about, certainly not in the way John Kennedy did. John Kennedy grew up fascinated with history. He was reading history all his life, voraciously gobbling up largely English history, but history. And he would read and did read Barbara Tuchman, The Guns of August, and it really did have an impact on it. He sat there talking to his brother about it explicitly in the missile crisis, the moral of the story being, don't paint your opponent into a corner. Give him a way out. This has had some relevance to the current crisis, but that things can get out of control, small crises can become big ones if you don't think about an exit strategy, and if you don't allow your opponent a way to back down. John Kennedy thought in those terms based on his own reading. Bush, I think, less so. I just don't think he's as reflective or as well-read. Now, hopefully, there are people around him who are, and he will be well-advised. And I don't mean at all to imply that he's a know-nothing. I don't mean that at all. Relative to John Kennedy, he's not historically astute or learned. Relative to whom else? I mean, I think he's probably at the low end. I'm trying to think of other presidents and how much they're read. I think he's probably at the low end of the scale. I mean, Clinton was pretty well read. Even Bush's father read more than I think the son. Reagan, it turns out, was not nearly the dope that we made him out to be. I mean, there's this interesting book just out now with this radio addresses, where it's clear that he thought a great deal about the issues he was pondering, more so than many politicians of his time. And it was a bum rap just to see him as a movie actor. Certainly, Jerry Ford, maybe there's a model for you. I doubt Jerry Ford was a great reader. I don't know that, though. Phil, do you know? Did Ford read?
I think your instincts are pretty good, as always.
Don Nachter,
I'd like to get you to move on to a couple of foreign policy issues, additional ones. What about Macedonia and the Israeli-Palestinian issue? How much potential is there for those to become crises in the next year? Adam Albright had a piece in the Washington Post yesterday saying we've got to stay in the Balkans and we ought to get involved in Macedonia.
Yeah.
So how do you analyze all that?
Before you answer the question about Macedonia, I did think of one other person. Franklin Roosevelt was not much of a reader.
It's interesting. He was intuitive. And
He loved to, he interacted with people through conversations, long conversations, but he was never known as a reader.
Yeah. Well, it depends where you get your information. You don't have to get it out of books. You can get your information out of a number of sources, but that puts a premium on being well-advised. If you get your information out of conversations, you better hope those conversations are with people who are reading and are thinking. And I think of Roosevelt's advisors, they were more thoughtful.
Macedonia.
The question is Macedonia in the Middle East. I've started to see, Holbrooke also had a piece that we got to get engaged. Again, I think, and I don't know enough about the particulars here, but my strong sense is that Bush wants to back off everywhere. He just doesn't want to get involved in the nitty-gritty of any of these crises if he could possibly help it. He's seen his predecessors get burned. It temperamentally suits him to have a hands-off attitude, to not rush into things, to not micromanage things, which is a leadership style and not all bad, but at some point, and it's also a reaction against Clinton, who I think, to take the Middle East, I think he feels that Clinton overmanaged the Middle East, that he created a problem by pushing the sides into peace talks before they were ready. That may ultimately be the judgment of history as well, that Clinton began to believe his own powers as a peacemaker and healer and became so grandiose about him, he forced the parties into negotiations that were doomed to fail because they weren't ripe. Bush is taking the opposite tack. There are so many things that can go wrong here that it makes you, I worry more about the Middle East than I do about Macedonia. There's going to be killing, there's going to be unpleasantness there, but it's not going to directly affect U.S. national security. The Middle East is a whole different cup of tea. Just to paint one sort of scary scenario, I think our worry about things getting inflamed there is that the so-called Arab street, the people in the streets in these various Arab countries will get inflamed and topple their governments. And the government you have to worry about is in Jordan, not a particularly rich country. For a long time, King Hussein kept it together, and his son, I gather, is doing okay. But I think there's always a risk that extremists are going to bring down that government. Now, if they did, and you had radicals in charge there, that would create an opening for Saddam. I mean, you could see it's quite possible that if you got a really extremist radical government, they would invite Saddam in. That would create a tremendous and horrible crisis for the United States, because Israel would not tolerate Saddam's tanks rumbling into a country right on their border. They might have to go to war against Iraq. We would get sucked right into that, and we would find ourselves in the middle of a general war in the Middle East. Now, that scenario may be a little far-fetched, but I don't think it's all that far-fetched. A few dominoes have to topple, but I could. So I'm more worried about the Middle East than I am about about Macedonia. I hope I'm wrong about that scenario, but it doesn't seem to be all that improbable.
You had a question.
Oh, thank you. Lighter note, the first 100 days of Bush's administration, how big an impact do you think the Florida vote debacle had? And that was so big for so long, and it sort of like fizzled out. And how is, do you think it affected him in being unambitious and limited in his scope?
The question is, what was the impact of the Florida vote debacle? He's had some recent good news, as you know. A Miami Herald study, they looked at all of the undervotes, all those hanging chads, in the counties that would have to have been recounted if the Florida Supreme Court had been upheld. And they found everybody's surprise, pretty much everybody's surprise, that Bush won. So it takes a little bit of the conspiracy theory out of the hardcore Democratic cry that we were robbed and the election was stolen and the U.S. Supreme Court, Scalia and all those evil right-wing justices stole the election from us, because apparently, had they gone forward and allowed the recounts to happen in these Florida counties, Bush would have won anyway. So that effectively takes some of the steam out of the conspiracy theories, but only some of it, because once people believe a conspiracy theory, it gets locked in, and no matter what the facts show, there will always be a fair number of Democrats who believe that it was stolen, and they will point to other evidence. There will be surveys showing that I think that probably that Gore would have won the over votes, which are the ballots that were either punched twice or where there's a write-in and a punch. And he might have won a statewide recount. So there's more evidence still to come in. Again, the facts don't get in the way of good mythology here. There is a core of Democrats, particularly African Americans, who will always believe that they were robbed. And that will give the Democrats, every party on the outs needs to remember Alsace-Lorraine. You know, they need to remember something, some injustice that was done, to fire them up so they can come back the next time around. The impact on Bush, it's mixed. In one sense, he gets criticized for governing as if he had his real mandate. This is this whole business of governing from the right. But as I said earlier, it's sort of an unambitious conservative mandate. Yes, it's further to the right than you might have expected from a guy who would barely won or lost a popular vote, barely won. You would think, well, he wants to stay in the center, so why is he going right? Well, he's going right because he's pretending he has a mandate to go right. Well, he doesn't really. That misses the larger point to me, which is he's not doing anything terribly ambitious. And I think that is partly because he knows he doesn't have a giant mandate here. He did not win overwhelmingly. I mean, Ronald Reagan won an electoral landslide in 1980, and he was able to say, hey, look at the map here, look at all those red, I forget, the Republicans red and the Democrats blue, or is it the other way around? Look at all those states that are painted in red. I have a mandate to turn away from the liberalism of the past. I'm sure Bush does not feel that way. So I think it limits his ambition. But I should also say, I think his ambition was pretty limited anyways.
Just a question again about Florida and also the energy source. Do you think Bush is going to get into any conflict with his brother with the issue of looking for oil, going for oil offshore in the Gulf?
Yeah. I've read that they're looking everywhere but offshore in the Gulf. All politics is local. Yeah. And I would be shocked if he picked a fight with his brother over that. You know, they've scaled back, and they're not going to drill on the north slope of Alaska, or at least right away. They backed off of that. That was a concession, a little bit of a concession to the noise level from the media and from environmentalists that they had gone too far. I think it was also a recognition that it would be 10 years before you got any oil out of Anwar, and Bush is going to be the commissioner of Major League Baseball by then, so he won't care. But I'm always fascinated by the relationship between the brothers. It has a Shakespearean element, as you know, because a lot of people felt that Jeb was the smart one and the ambitious one, and he was the one who was going to be president. And George Bush was a kind of feckless older brother. Then by the accident of those gubernatorial campaigns, Jeb surprisingly lost, George surprisingly won, and the roles were reversed. I do know that there was a lot of tension in that family over whether Jeb Bush would deliver Florida or not. And there's a striking scene that we were told about on election night at 6 o'clock at night when the networks called Florida for the Democrats. Jeb Bush cries on his, embraces his brother and weeps. That's a lot of tension. These are men who don't cry all that easily. That's a lot of built up tension when his emotions are that close to the surface. And then he just left. He went to his hotel room and was seen standing there in his underwear drinking scotch, thinking it was all over. And then the networks reversed themselves and called Florida for Republicans. After all, I went back and forth all night, and he returned from the dead.
A.D. Hart.
Do you have a view as to whether a gubernatorial experience or congressional experience is a better profile for a presidential candidate?
Well, I it's been a long time since we elected a senator.
Could you repeat the question?
The question was, is a gubernatorial profile or a senatorial profile a better model for being president? I don't know what the gods are telling us. I think if you look at recent history, there hasn't been a senator as president since LBJ, right? Isn't he the last senator? I think that's right. So, but there have been some governors. And I think the notion is that there are two issues here. One is everybody runs against Washington. So if you're a senator, it's hard to run against Washington. Some senators have managed to do it, but it's sort of campaigning 101 now to run against Washington, and it's just harder if you're a senator. It's easier if you're a governor.
Actually, the last one elected as a senator was Kennedy.
Was Jack Kennedy, yeah.
Because Johnson was only elected as an incumbent president.
Right. So you got to go back quite a ways. The other issue is just executive leadership. The governors can get things done and demonstrate executive leadership. And these states are little laboratories of democracy, as somebody wrote. And they can be innovative and try things and kind of be fresher than Washington. Whereas a senator doesn't have that power. And we've lost some of our respect for the Senate as a great debating forum. All the cliches about Webster and all that have long since faded. And you can argue that C-SPAN has done more to diminish our opinion of our elected representatives than to help it. We thought when we were bringing cameras in there, this would be great. We'll let citizens see what democracy is like. Well, they watched. Actually, more cruelly, what happens is that clips are taken off of C-SPAN. And, of course, the networks show the worst case. They show the loudest mouths and, you know, crazy Bob Dornan railing at the... And so that the 11 o'clock news makes Congress look more ridiculous than it actually is. Congress is a very ponderous, slow-paced place that has a lot of different voices. But what you see distilled for you on the evening news is typically the worst. And that has further diminished our respect for
Innes Claude.
If Bush doesn't want to do anything very much as president, why do you think he's so eager to win 4 extra years to do it?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's instinctive of politicians. Running is what they do. I mean, Bill Clinton is the extreme form of this, who's like a reciprocating engine that if he ever stopped, he'd just collapse. And, you know, continue to be president after he was president. I mean, he just, the whole notion of the perpetual campaign which Dick Morris taught Bill Clinton as a young governor, that you are always running. You're never just governing, you're always running. That's become sort of embedded in American political life, and you have an infrastructure that's always running. Karl Rove, who's arguably the most persuasive person at the White House, is by definition already thinking about 2004. They poll now, well, actually, Clinton polled a lot. Bush is not polling so much, which is interesting. He's not polling so much. So I think it's sort of a reflex. Now, having said that, Bush goes out of his way to say, look, he did go out of his way when he was running for president, saying, if I don't win, I've got a life. I got my cat and my dog and my ranch and my wife, and I'll just go home. And he half meant it. You know, Gore was saying, you don't understand, if I lose, this is the end of the world for me. That's not what Bush was saying. And I think that Bush is somebody who could accept going home with this big exception. He has a very bitter memory of watching his father lose re-election. That was a very painful family moment. I mean, think of, we're all prideful. We all hate to be embarrassed. Imagine what it's like to be embarrassed in that way. And it was horrible, and W remembers that, and I think he wants to vindicate his father, and to get into the depths of psychobabble here, top his father by winning a second term. But that's, I'm getting far afield.
Last question, Nancy Houston.
If you could go back to China for a moment, I assume that maybe George W. looks to his father for some advice. Do you know whether that's going on? Or is it
I'm sure it's going on. Does W turn to as they call him, does 43 turn to 41 for advice on China? Absolutely. Now, the White House is falling all over itself to not comment on this, but they do it in such a way that makes it obvious that W's talking to his father all the time. Now, how substantive that is and what that conversation is really like, unfortunately, since Richard Nixon ruined taping for us, we won't ever know, and Phil won't be able to transcribe it, or Phil's successors won't be able to transcribe it in future years. So we'll never really know, but I hope somebody's keeping a diary somewhere, because it would be fascinating to know what that conversation is really like, whether it's how substantive it is, whether it's just exhortation, or whether they get down to the nitty-gritty, whether the father is telling the son how to read the Chinese. After all, he was an envoy over there and spent a lot of time in his own administration dealing with these issues. I just don't know, but I sure wish I did.
We've proved two things this morning. One, that the comments that were made in the beginning are correct about the quality of your questioning. My only hope is that you would match that quality with your generosity in giving, so we can go forward and finance the whole. And the other thing is that we're off to a very challenging, spirited, the kind of presentation one would expect of Evan Thomas. And now it's on to R.W. Apple, Howard Feynman, all the rest that we've made arrangements for. And we hope you'll be as faithful in attending those forums. Thank you very much, and thank you.